Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic. If you're looking for a snack that packs a punch, look no further than Avionola, a granola that can be taken on the go, and it's so versatile that it can be eaten as a snack or as a meal.
We love Avionola because of its nutritional content. Lots of granolas have a high sugar content, but not Avionola. This granola is sweetened with monk fruit, so it actually doesn't spike your blood sugar, and it's a great option for those who may be diabetic or looking for a low sugar alternative compared to other granolas. I mean, what could be better than a granola that only has 1 gram of sugar?
Not to mention it's keto approved, so that means it's only got 1 gram of carbohydrates, and this is because it's made with lupini beans. And y'all, I have to tell you right now, I would have no idea this wasn't made from a grain because it tastes so good. So go grab yourself a bag of Avionola at avi-foods.com and upgrade your granola fix right now. Use our code PILOTSPANDEMIC for 15% off your first order.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Pilots Pandemic podcast. You're here with your host, Emma, me, myself, and I, and our lovely co-host, Maddie.
Hello, everybody.
And this week, we are joined with a guest, Adrian, known as @CheesePilot on Instagram, TikTok, pretty much every platform of social media. So, hi, Adrian. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, how's it going?
Yes, thank you for joining us today, Adrian. I kind of wanted to let everybody know that how we met you first, because we always typically meet everybody over like Instagram, but this time I found you on TikTok from our latest guest that we had, Tegan, and her handle was @Let's Fly Tailwheels. And I'm really glad she had tagged me in one of your posts, because other people have recommended you and said, hey, Adrian should come on. And I was like, that's so ironic, because I just spoke with him. So your story has really been motivating and inspiring to hear. And I know that it's probably pretty difficult for you to be in the situation that you're in. But I wanted to ask you first, because we start with every guest, we ask them how they got into aviation. So what kind of sparked your passion in aviation, or who was the person that kind of brought you into the aviation industry?
So my kind of, you know, how I got into aviation, I guess it's a little bit different than, you know, how some people got in. You know, you always hear it was like, oh, well, my dad was a pilot, my mom was a pilot, you know, we had airplanes or what have you. one of my first memories, I had to have been, you know, 5 or 6 years old. I went to an air show, I think with the Cub Scouts, and some biplane flew upside down, like dumping smoke all over the cars, you know, driving into this air show. And from that moment, I was like, I want to do that, you know. But when I went and told my, you know, mom, you know, when she came back from, you know, her dispatchment to Korea when she was in the military, you know, I tell her I want to be a pilot, and they literally laughed at me because of the cost and the fact that, you know, back then I my vision was so bad I needed glasses to find my glasses. So I got into aviation kind of accidentally. I graduated college with my first associates at 19 into the 2008 recession, or at the very least the recovery from the 2008 recession. So there wasn't any jobs. I ended up joining the military. I tore my ACL in the military, so I couldn't infantry anymore. And I had gotten out of the military with not really any plan or anything like that, until I saw a sign at an airport saying that you could use your GI Bill here to become a pilot. And once I realized that that was an option to use my GI Bill to become a pilot, I realized I finally, well, could afford it. So I dug around looking for schools. My initial plan was actually go to the University of North Dakota. But believe it or not, there's a website called undsucks.com. And I saw it and that kind of scared me away. So I decided to go to ASU's program down in Arizona. And as soon as I show up, the VA cut ASU off. So I have to go next door to this community college that partnered with the University of North Dakota.
Full circle.
So, you know, I did all my flight training there. Took me about 18 months to go from pretty much 0 hours to flight instructor. And then another 13 months to go from, you know, flight instructor to airline pilot. So I definitely took one of the accelerated routes.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think we've talked to anyone who has like a parent in the military, but specifically their mother, which is extremely interesting way to grow up. But and I could probably sit here and talk to you about that forever, but I kind of have to stay on subject. But I know you're not currently flying. And like you said, you know, you're talking about your career trajectory and it seems like you got in, did your flight training, and it looks like you were currently at the airlines. But can you kind of take me through your flight training and how you got there?
So if we go back to, you know, zero, I did, you know, ASU, when they got cut off from the VA, they kind of left all the veterans just kind of hanging dry until a big group of the veterans decided to go to the news and ASU went, hey, don't go to the news and we'll give you all a semester for free. So they gave a bunch of veterans one semester for free, including me. So I got, believe it or not, about 100 hours from private pilot, which is kind of a lot when it comes to just private pilot training. And through that one semester, I never took my check ride. And I'm like, am I really cut out to be a pilot? 100 hours and I still haven't even gotten the first rating done? It's looking a little rough. That one semester where I didn't finish the private pilot program, I moved next door to Chandler Gilbert Community College in partnership with the University of North Dakota, or technically UND Aerospace Foundation. And with a new instructor at a new program, I got it done in about 30 hours on top of the other 100 hours that I had. So if anyone's ever thinking that they're not cut out to be a pilot because they're taking longer than the average of 73 hours, nah, keep at it.
Not a lot of people are willing to talk about that, especially in the day and age of like 141 flight schools where you're really turning and burning and pumping it out as quick as you can and getting every single rating in 6 months. And you, there is like, we talked about this. We just did our solo episode. It will be 2 weeks ago from when this comes out, but we talked about that a lot in that episode. So I really appreciate you being honest about that. And sometimes really all it takes is a different experience. The first flight school I went to, I was not thriving. And then I went to another flight school and my experience totally changed.
Yep. And that's why, you know, when I was a flight instructor, if it got to a point where I didn't, you know, where I didn't make progress for about three flights, I was not ashamed to hand my student off to another instructor to see if I was the problem, which I feel is like there's a lot of problems in, you know, flight schools and aviation, especially at a lot of the really small schools where there's only like two or three instructors. There isn't really the opportunity to pass off your student to another instructor to see if there's possibly a teaching method that you're not understanding. So I've never been ashamed about the fact that it took me almost twice the national average to get my pilot's license. And whenever anyone asks, like, hey, you know, am I cut out for it? I'm already at 38 hours and I haven't even soloed. Like, well, I was at like 42 before I soloed. So keep after it. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I respect that.
You said that because I'm going through my flight training right now. I'm only at 10 hours. And it's like, Emma and I have talked about this many times, but it's just like, everyone asks you, like, when are you going to be able to fly? When are you soloing? And all of these things. And it's kind of like, well, I don't have a time frame. I just know that I'll do it when I'm ready. But it's hard to say that pilot to pilot because it's just like they, you're expected to like do it at the time frame that has kind of been like the average, as they say. But Yeah, it's definitely something that takes time for every person to learn, and that everybody learns differently. So thank you for saying that, because I think that there definitely is a push to do things very fast. And that kind of takes the joy out of learning a lot of times. So so moving on, I kind of wanted to ask you, like, as you ascended to the airlines and you got your airline gig, in our pre-podcast conversation, you kind of talked about how you got typed in a new aircraft and then this big hiccup with your medical came along. So can you share with our audience how that happened or why that happened?
So, you know, I was working on my third type rating. I had, you know, went from the regionals to a low-cost carrier, where I was in the A320. So I made it through, you know, a third type rating, another rating. And then my medical was going to expire like 2 days before, I was supposed to go back to work. You know, my first class medical privileges were going to expire. So I was going to go get my eighth medical exam expecting no issues, just like the previous seven. And then I guess this, aviation medical examiner dug up 17 years worth of medical records that I still, 98 days later, cannot track down. And that aviation medical examiner refuses to discuss where they got the medical records from. They say they got them from the VA. I call the VA and they're like, dude, we don't even know you went to Afghanistan, let alone talk to a therapist in Afghanistan.
Yeah. So what do you think was the big tip off, and like, explain that a little bit more?
You know, Afghanistan, it was Afghanistan. You know, we were up all night, holding guard. And when I say all night, I'm talking about like 8 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock in the morning. We were, you know, reduced to one bottle of water and one MRE a day. Our platoon sergeant kept volunteering us for increasingly more and more dangerous missions, for no real reason either. Like there wasn't an end goal. By the time, you know, by this time in our deployment, our main mission was clean up our FOB and hand it over to the ANA, the Afghan National Army. So it kept getting worse and worse until, you know, our platoon sergeant abandoned us in Kabul. It was me and one other truck that wasn't even part of our platoon, and then a local national truck that was actually towing one of our trucks. And it was probably, you know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. I don't know. It was dark. The city was busy. And next thing you know, we got separated and we were in trucks that the Crow system, the gun system, didn't work. We really had no way to defend ourselves. The trucks had no radios. All we had was a SATCOM radio in hopes that it might be able to get back to, our FOB or BAF, which is where we were going, but no way to really communicate between trucks other than, you know, flashing our lights. But we got cut off by some vehicles and made some wrong turns here and there. And next thing you know, we can't find the rest of the platoon. So we get to the other side of the city. We wait there for about 45 minutes thinking that maybe we beat them. And we didn't, you know, we waited for about 45 minutes and no one ever showed up. So we just kept driving in the general direction that we thought Kabul was, or not Kabul, but BAF. And next thing you know, we find the rest of our platoon just driving on without us. So once we got to BAF, I had a very colorful conversation with my platoon sergeant and pretty much explained that I was done. I need to go talk to some professionals. I'm no longer going to be in this platoon with you. You're going to get us killed. You know, you're continuing to put us in dangerous situations. So I went and talked to a therapist in Afghanistan about, you know, everything that was going on in Afghanistan, all the heinous stuff that the rest of my platoon mates were doing. I got pulled out from that platoon and got attached to the supply sergeant. And I was the supply sergeant's guard for the rest of the deployment. And that was the end of it. So
yeah.
I didn't think anything of it. Nothing else changed. I just got removed, or I don't want to say removed, but I just got reattached to my supply sergeant as opposed to a whole platoon. Wow. I still had my weapon. I still had all 24 grenades. I still was expected to be an infantryman. So I didn't think anything of it. You know, I had some follow-up you know, meetings, continuing on with the therapist, just making sure everything was okay. And I, you know, when we all came back from Afghanistan, we all had like 2 appointments with a therapist. And again, we were all okay. We were all doing just fine. You know, as fine as you can be. And, you know, life went on. So I didn't think anything of it until this aviation medical examiner pulls it up. And apparently there was, I guess, some disqualifying diagnoses from that Afghanistan medical record that, except for this aviation medical examiner, I can't find any record of.
So like you said, you had called the VA and there's no record of this diagnosis or you ever even taking therapy?
Yes.
Huh.
So, and that's the thing, I've called this aviation medical examiner trying to figure out where he got it. Cause obviously the FAA wants the records. Right. And All he got was like a little snippet, you know, he just got like a small little briefing, like, hey, he went to therapy this many times. This is this is his problem list. This is the diagnosis, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, well, where did you get that? Cause I've never seen that a day in my life. And I have my entire medical record right here on my phone. So I don't know where you got that. There must be a mistake. And
so now I want to ask you a question that's like, you might not have an answer to, but it's like, if you can't find this paperwork and you know the FAA is going to require it from you, like, how do you even move forward in that situation? Like, have you been able to get any kind of guidance or advice on like how to obtain that record?
Well, here's the thing. I filled out, it's a form SF-180, but I have even called the National Personnel Records in St. Louis and San Antonio, you know, the place that has every record. You know, like if you want to know what your grandpa did in World War II, these are the people to call. And even they're like, yeah, we don't have medical records from Afghanistan. We don't have downrange medical records.
So do you think this enemy is kind of targeting you?
So what I want to say and what I can say legally are 2 different things.
Okay.
Cause I don't want to risk, like, let's just be frank. I don't want to risk a defamation suit because I can't prove anything.
Yeah.
You know,
but if the, you know, the lines or the stars match up.
Well, like, would I be able to say that you've done work for a certain organization? You're not saying it. Would I be able to say that? Because it's public knowledge.
Yeah, I do work for, you know, certain organizations that could be stigmatized by certain political regimes.
Okay. Yes, yes. One of our previous guests that we've had on. If you just want to put 2 and 2 together, something extremely relevant to do with women's health and gender identifying surgery. So, gender affirming care, excuse me. Sorry. So you can kind of put 2 and 2 together. I like, and that makes me sick to my stomach. And, but I honestly, it's not that far-fetched of an idea.
And I agree with that because, you know, my previous, cause I had to go to a new aviation medical examiner. I've been going to one, you know, the same one for, you know, the past 3 years. And my previous one no longer wanted to see me because I was on the news for that organization.
Okay. Yeah.
So it would make sense. The track. We've got
the shoe fits, lace it up.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
So for you, Adrian, what has kind of been like the hardest for you going through this process? Is it just like not being able to obtain the records or the length of the process, or what's the hardest part going through?
I would definitely say the length of the process and the response of the FAA when you get them on the phone. Okay. They are not helpful. They're to be frank, they're rude. You know, when I even asked, I was like, hey, can I go talk to a different aviation medical examiner? Does that look like I'm trying to commit fraud? And they went, I don't know. I'm like, aren't you the people that would know? You know, and it's a little ridiculous because this aviation medical examiner, you know, after he was like, hey, we're going to defer your medical, blah, 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 blah. It's going to be 4 to 6 weeks. Even the aviation medical examiners don't understand this process.
No, they don't.
That aviation medical examiner told me to my face that you're going to be looking at 4 to 6 weeks. It's not going to be a big deal.
I mean, that's what the federal air surgeon says with special issuances. She's like, oh, it's only taking 6 months when in reality it's taking 24. So,
well, I'm going to be honest. Ever since I got the congressional staffers to reach out to the FAA, they have been alarmingly responsive.
That's good. I'm glad.
So if you are going through this process, what I do recommend is using this service called Fax Zero so that you can actually fax the FAA. You can only do like 3 pages unless you want to pay like $3. Not sponsored. That's just the service I use. All right. That's just what I use to fax the FAA. And I send it snail mail and I fax it. And get a congressional staffer to reach out to the FAA and have them blatantly ask, like, hey, you guys said it was going to take me 28 days to get a response. Why are we at 45 days now?
Yeah. Did you realize like what you were up against when you started this, like from when you walked out of the AME's office, like, did you take his word for it?
I mean, I was pretty distraught. I'm going to be honest. Yeah. I was ugly crying.
Yeah.
You know, I was sniveling, snot running down my face. Like yeah. It was rough because, you know,
I felt like your life was like ending. It just feels like earth shattering.
It is, you know, especially when you're this far into a career with no other resources to go otherwise. You know, yeah. if this would have came up when I got my first medical, you know, when I went in for my first medical exam years ago, if this would have been brought up and they would have went, hey, like, it's probably going to take you like $6,000 to $20,000 to fight this. You might want to think of a different career. I'd go, oh, okay. And to be honest, I would have stayed at Geek Squad in freaking New York. But you know, it didn't get brought up because it wasn't in my medical record. No aviation medical examiner found it until now.
Yeah. So like, that's the thing, that the problem I have there is this actually happens quite a bit where pilots get their first class and then something happens where their AME is like, oh, we found something. And yours seems to be particularly special in that you can't figure out where that diagnosis came from. Mm-hmm. But it's just like the inconsistency of you being able to obtain a first class and then now, and how many years later has it been, like 10 that they have?
So the therapy was 10 years ago.
Okay.
And I got my first medical about 7 years ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's even this 3-year gap between the therapy and my first medical where I didn't receive any other mental health services. So it's not like, you know, people have made the comment, oh, well, maybe you shouldn't have been lying to your AME if you were, you know, seeking out these healthcare services for these diagnoses. Like, I wasn't. I wasn't, you know, because they always talk about that United guy that was taking bipolar meds for a decade and then was like, I didn't know they were for bipolar. It's like, dude, you went to Walgreens for the last 10 years picking up these meds and you never once read the side of the bottle. And now he wants to sue the VA for $35 million for overdiagnosis. And it's like, dude, you were taking disability for it. You were taking medication for it. And now all of a sudden when you got caught, you want to call foul. It's like, no, you doing this is the reason that this happens. And I'm going to be honest. I feel pretty guilty about this whole, you know, HIMSS process, this whole aviation medical process. Cause I used to be an advocate for HIMSS. I would tell people like, hey, if you are struggling through something that you need to speak to a professional for, go to a professional. Here's the HIMSS program. This is the very basic steps that you need to follow just from, you know, reading the FAA's documentation, reading the forms that need to be filled out. It looks like a fairly simple, straightforward process. It's not. It's not. It incentivizes you to hide, especially when you look into, you know, the disqualifications for things like basic med and LSA and, you know, light sport aircraft. If you lose your medical by speaking out and getting the healthcare that you need, you lose the option to do sport pilot. You lose the option for basic med.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just shut the fuck up and fill out your basic med form, go have a nice day.
Yeah.
And that's the most disgusting part about it is the fact that the FAA not only makes it extremely difficult to go through the special issuance process for mental health through the PIMS program, but that there's an easier process for you to just shut the fuck up and not do anything and not say anything.
Yeah. I mean,
it incentivizes pilots to hide.
It really does.
Manipulation tactic.
It's just guilty until proven innocent.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Which I understand they want to err on the side of caution, but then leave it up to the treating physician. That's been my biggest push for this is leave it up to the treating physician. For cancer, the oncologist decides on whether or not the pilot's safe to go back to flying. Why is it any different for mental health services?
Yeah. It's the same thing even with physical health. Like I talk about this a lot. Like when I started this whole process, when I created the petition, when I started the podcast, I knew that things were fundamentally wrong, that the system was broken, that it was outdated or archaic, but I really truly had no clue the lack of, honestly, just the lack of respect of life that the FAA has for these people. I mean, one of our most recent episodes, we talked to Victoria Sides, and she had a heart defect when she was young, something that she took care of when she was extremely young and has lived a very happy, healthy life since then. When she went to go get her medical, of course, the FAA was requiring a multitude of testing for her, and almost like, it's, I think it's two or three doctors basically like told her, no, I'm not ordering these tests for you. These tests are going to put your health at more danger than you already are. You're a perfectly healthy person. Why would I order a test for you when you're perfectly healthy? A test that's I'm going to inject you with nuclear dye. Like, it's just putting you at more risk that isn't even there. And it's just, I don't know. It's just crazy. And every single year she has to go and do that, the nuclear stress test. And there are thousands of people that have to do that every single year. And it makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense. You talk to any physician about that process and they're like, yeah, no, why?
And that's why these aviation medical examiners being able to have this much of a strangle on people's entire livelihoods is wrong. Are we really going to say that ENT, you know, no shame to ENTs, but that ENT that did the paperwork with the FAA to also become an AME that now has a private practice office right next to the subway in the strip mall in Milwaukee has any idea on whether or not somebody with a heart defect as a child is safe to fly? Or does that doctor who actually helped that person through their entire healthcare regime have a better idea on whether or not that person is safe to fly?
Exactly. And it's such common sense. That's the wildest part about it all is when you try and explain this to people who aren't in aviation, which I bet you've kind of come across that a lot. Like, it's so frustrating to have to explain this to people on the outside, because it's just, it's so blatantly common sense that it's almost like saying it aloud, it almost feels like you're just spreading false information. It just doesn't even feel right, but it's the truth.
That's been the alarming thing, is the amount of people that have actually reached out in my comments saying, stop spreading this information, pilots can go to therapy.
Yeah. I mean, we've had that argument so many times.
And if you pay cash and ensure that there is no diagnosis, sure, you can. But the problem is the FAA leaves that fun little ETC at the end of their guidance to AMEs, saying that, pretty much allowing them to defer anybody who has had any mental health diagnoses, whether it be acute adjustment disorder for a stressful event.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. If you want insurance to pay the $300 an hour it takes to go to therapy nowadays, you are going to get acute adjustment disorder at the very least.
Yeah. At the end of the day, they have to put something down. And if they write something down, that's enough cause for the FAA to be like, oh, let's investigate this further. Which just, oh my God.
And I think what sucks also is that when they write a diagnosis, oftentimes they're giving you a diagnosis so that your insurance will cover it, because they can't just prescribe you medication without a diagnosis. So that's a lot of times they do that so that you're in, for your insurance purposes. And that's what's frustrating. A lot of people don't think about that, is like, oh, my doctor's actually trying to help me out to get the medication that I need. But at the end of it, you have a diagnosis and the FAA is going to be like, well, we have an issue with this.
Yes. Yeah. And the alarming thing is the FAA couldn't care less about the fact that I tumbled off my motorcycle at 75 miles an hour and broke 6 transverse processes along my spine. FAA doesn't care about that at all. No. But I went to therapy in a war zone.
Yeah.
That's all of a sudden an issue. And now the FAA is even saying, we want all the information about your eyeball surgery too, from when you got PRK. And I'm like, last time I checked, PRK has never been a disqualifying has never been a disqualifying surgery. Pilots get LASIK all the time.
Yeah. What the?
I'm like, but so.
It just, honestly, it just feels so discriminatory, like between what we've talked about in the pre-podcast recording, what we've kind of said on here. And then on top of the fact that like you fought for this country, you put your life on the line. And I worked with the military, and that's something that's like very near and dear to my heart, is the sacrifices that men and women make for this country. And for them to use that against you and put your job, your livelihood on the line over something that happened to you while you were making sure that the men and women in this country could still continue to live their lives is infuriating, really infuriating. It's, yeah, I'm very sorry that this is happening to you, because that's just, you should not be being treated like this. Like, it's just ridiculous.
And if the process was quicker and affordable, that is my biggest gripe, which is why I've kind of been toying around with the idea of a nonprofit, and that I'm between two names, Psych and Hers. Hers is like a direct, you know, opposition to HIMSS, you know, the Human Intervention and Motivation Study. Yeah. You know, what was the acronym that I came up with? It was like, humans enacting real solutions.
I like it.
I like that.
Or, you know, either Psych, you know, pilots supporting your costly HIMSS.
Yeah.
It's great. Yep.
To ensure that it's not a matter of cost, for the HIMSS program, because it's, there are unions that will support you through the alcoholism portion of HIMSS. You ask them to support the mental health portion of HIMSS, they'll laugh at you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, we can go from, you know, Budweiser to Boeing or cocaine to Concord, but I went to therapy and you have issue with that.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense. So, since you were talking about price, can we ask you like how much you've spent so far?
So far, I've spent about $200 at Target. My initial, cause I did just go to just a basic VA psych eval, cause that's all the FAA asked me for initially. The FAA then sent me a letter before even receiving my psych eval. They sent me a letter saying they wanted me to go see a HIMSS psych. And I'm like, okay, well, initially you didn't want me to go see a HIMSS psych and you haven't even gotten any more info. And now all of a sudden you want me to go to a HIMSS psych. But the HIMSS psych is ranging anywhere from 2 to 6,000. Haven't spent it yet. They're waiting on my VA blue ribbon report. And I am trying to work with Ramos Law to help on the legal aspect. And they range anywhere from $3,000 to $6,000.
Which, steady plug.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you.
No endorsement or anything from
no,
them.
No serious just... endorsement. We love
it. We love Joe.
Joe's been on the podcast two times and we love Ramos Law and we love Joe LaRusso. So we love them. We endorse it all day long.
Well, and that's the thing. They had one of their legal aides give me a call saying like, hey, you know, we see that you're trying to sue the AME for a HIPAA violation. That's not something we can do, but this is what we do. And I'm like, okay. And I was trying to figure out, you know, what the value was, because, you know, from what this legal aid was explaining to me is it seemed something, you know, like I could do myself, you know, I can, you know, pilots are all trained to read the FAR AIM, you know, and understand the regs and be able to navigate the regs. So I was, you know, getting a little confused on what the $3,000 to $6,000 was going to be paid, or, you know, what was it going to do? And Joe ended up sitting on the phone with me for about an hour explaining to me what they were doing, and that it wasn't something that I can generally, you know, I can try, but good luck. But also explaining that AME, you can't sue an AME for a HIPAA violation. They are protected under the same kind of, like, he akined it to how it's really hard to sue a cop for a civil rights violation. You know, qualified immunity effectively, because they're operating as a governmental agent.
Yeah. Mm.
So, but apparently the VA disagrees about it being a HIPAA violation. So I don't understand that. Accessing 17 years of medical records that even I don't have access to that he never got a release for. That sounds like a pretty blatant HIPAA violation to me, but I guess I'm not a lawyer. So,
yeah, I don't, you know, that's one thing that's come up on the podcast and Maddie and I have talked about, and there's so much just gray area when it comes to like the VA, the FAA and your AME and the HIPAA violation and where that all comes into play. Because I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, it is a HIPAA violation. And a lot of people swear to me up and down that no, it isn't. And I'm of the opinion on that, unless you put a paper right in front of me and say, hey, we are going to access these records, sign off on this, please, then it's a HIPAA violation. I don't remember what I signed when I was 14, 15 years old, going to my family doctor. Like the first medical that I held, I was 15 years old, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So how, like, it's just, I don't know. I feel like for me, there's a fine line between something that's just like fundamentally correct and fundamentally wrong. And I feel like accessing that information, not being able to tell the person where you access the information, is very contradictory. You know what I mean?
And that's the more alarming part, is like, so you can grab it, because it's the way it was explained to me in the letter that the VA sent me is that an occupational exam is treated as well, treatment. So accessing a medical record is a continuation of treatment. That's the way that the VA explained it to me. And but they can't then release those records to you.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, what? I don't even know where those ones came from. So, yeah. You know, and the even more frustrating part is I've had, you know, the doc from Afghanistan say, nah, you're good. You know, you don't equip somebody with 240 rounds out of an M4 and a grenade launcher and a, you know, grenade launcher machine gun that shoots 350 rounds per minute if you're concerned about their mental well-being.
Yeah.
And then
that opinion should be like worth its weight in gold, but it's not even being considered.
Nope. But, and then I've also had two other doctors from the VA who are obviously well-versed in, you know, treating veterans from their experience from war. And they've written a letter going, nah, this guy's good. This guy's fine. We have no reason, like, you know, they pretty much put their I don't want to say livelihood or license or anything like that. I don't know the whole legality behind that, but they have endorsed me saying, yeah, I'd be comfortable flying with him.
Yeah.
Well,
we talked to a lot of people, and I mean, that seems to be, you know, you have these, I forget who it was that I was telling, but it's almost like an insult to the doctor, to the physician as well, because it's like, it's just a slap in the face to, you know, work with this person, be say you're treating this patient, et cetera, whatever it is, and to be able to write and put your professional, your job kind of on the line and say, hey, I'm vouching for this person is okay. And then for them to just be like, no, we don't need your opinion. We want to form our own opinion. And we haven't practiced medicine in like 25 years, but we need to formulate our own opinion.
And we all know that aviation medical examiner that, what's the words we use? Is very pilot friendly.
Yeah.
And there are hymns out there that are also just as pilot friendly. And when you look into the incidents where, whether it be a physical or mental ailment in which a pilot acted out or became incapacitated, their treating physician disagreed with the aviation medical examiner.
Mm-hmm.
Their treating physician would say that they were unsafe to fly. Their treating physician decided that they shouldn't be flying, but the FAA or the governing body wasn't aware of that treating physician's opinion because
they don't care.
Well, and because it's a self-disclosure system.
Yeah.
Unless the AME decides to dig into everything. You know, when I say this guy dug into everything, he knows I got a vaccine in middle school.
Yeah, that's wild.
I'm like, I don't remember that I got a vaccine in middle school.
Yep.
So, you know, the process that's in place right now is I'm just waiting for the HIMSS aviation medical examiner psychiatrist to get my FAA blue ribbon report, even though I've got one in my desk right now. They won't take it from me. They've got to wait for the FAA to mail it to them. Once that happens, I schedule who knows how many appointments. I'm going to obviously bring in the same letter that the VA doc wrote, pretty much saying like, hey, this guy's fine. And hopefully it all gets cleared up. I'm also going to be going to, you know, as we said, Ramos Law. I'm going to be reaching back out to them and having them, you know, they build me a legal standing and I guess a political standing. They told me that they do it kind of like a three-pronged attack. They have a political, medical, and legal standing for reissuing a pilot's medical certificate. So, you know, legal standing, interpreting the regulations into the modern day DSM-5, because apparently the FAA is still using the DSM-3, the same book that views, you know, homosexuality as a mental illness.
Which is what we talked about in our last episode. I was asking Tegan if she thought it was discriminatory to be tested, given a psych test, even though she's never had a psychological issue. And she said, yes. And I was like, I totally agree with you because I've been saying this is very discriminatory and they need to update it and they refuse to. So,
but and then the next one, you know, they have the legal, the medical, and then they apparently have a political arm in which they say, you know, wouldn't it be good press to give this pilot their medical back? Wouldn't this be good political clout to ensure that this pilot could fly again? Which that part feels disgusting.
Yeah, but it sucks that, like, oh God, I deal with that. We deal with that all too well. I mean, I've lost my father and my uncle over this, and some of the things that I've had to do, I feel like just like, yes, I'm bringing honor and respect to their name, but there's a part of it where, like, I feel like I shouldn't have to use that as like my bargaining chip, as like my clout or my story to affect change, you know? You should just be able to take it from face that, like, the system is messed up and I deserve to, in your case, I deserve to get my job back.
Yeah. And I mean, luckily enough, you know, my union has protected my job. That doesn't mean I'm getting paid.
Yeah.
But I still have a slot on the seniority list. So when I do get back to I'm going to have really good senior. I'm probably going to be one of the most senior first officers at the company.
Well, that would be nice.
Be able to bid whatever schedule I want.
You can have a great
time. Yeah, my company's currently going through union negotiations. You know, my believe it or not, my mail carrier, you know, obviously she's delivering all these letters from the FAA. So she's kind of got an idea of what's going on, just that I'm fighting to go back to work. And she keeps telling me that, hard times just protect you from worse things. So I guess being at the bottom of the seniority list while my company's going through union negotiations would be some pretty terrible experiences.
Yeah. Probably use the shit out of you if you were at work.
Yeah. Yeah. So, my mail carrier is awesome.
She sounds like it.
Gave you some good advice. I think for our last question, since you kind of already covered what your opinion was about how long it takes the FAA to issue your medical, is I'm going to take your question, Emma. If you have advice for anyone who's going through the process or just the special issuance process, what advice would you give them?
I'm start a GoFundMe, I guess. It's rough. If you've got the money, you know, obviously go for it. Now, if you're a student pilot or a veteran, you know, looking into the possibility of using your GI Bill to go become a pilot, and you're going to have to fight through this special issuance process, I definitely say contemplate using your GI Bill for a backup and using that job to pay for your flight training. Or if you're not looking to fly for a job, sport pilot, as long as you shut up, is an option. Yeah. That's really what my bit of advice would be, is if you have no intention of ever becoming an airline pilot or working, get basic med and go through sport pilot. Technically, you can go through private pilot on basic med. Well, you can even go.
I thought you were required to do like your third class, because when I was signing up for mine, because I just wanted to do basic med myself, because I just wanted to fly GA, you are required initially to have a third class.
Oh.
And then after you get your first third, you're allowed just to go to basic med, but you do have to get a third class.
Okay. So that was my misunderstanding.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, there goes my bit of advice. have a backup plan, I guess.
I think the GoFundMe was solid.
Yeah.
Start a GoFundMe. Because it sucks, because I see the other people that are in the same shoes as me, but don't have the same, I hate to say clout, that don't have the same audience as me, that are going to be left behind. They're not going to be able to afford this. They're not going to be able to go through this process. And all because, you know, I just happen to be normal enough for Elevated Access to reach out to me and me to become popular for standing up for what I believe is right. Now, all of a sudden, I'm allowed to go. I'm allowed to have the audience to support me to get back into flying, when there are countless other people that are in the same shoes as me that deserve it just as much as I do. Is I feel a little guilty.
Well, I don't think you should feel guilty. I think it's a shared experience. I feel that as well. I know that, like, even just having people on our show, like, there are so many people that Maddie and I can't get to, so many stories that we want to tell that, like, we just haven't been able to get to. But, you know, you did a good thing. What you did with Elevated Access was a good thing. So definitely don't feel guilty. Like, we're all rewarded for doing something somehow, some way. But comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah.
What was that?
I said comparison is the thief of joy.
Oh, I get it. So yeah. All right. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Comparing yourself to other people. All right.
Well, I mean, I'm just a firm believer of, like, you really can't, you know, you can't control other people's situations. You can only control your own. So I find myself a lot of the time, like, feeling bad for other people. I mean, you'd be a bad person if you didn't feel bad for other people in their situations and didn't sympathize with other people. But at the same time, you kind of just have to take it face that, like, this is your life. You're able to control your situation. And yeah, you may be a little bit more blessed than somebody else, but don't make yourself feel too entirely bad about it.
Yeah, just start a nonprofit called Psych that supports pilots for to fight through this process, right?
Exactly. Like, use your blessings to help bless other people. And it seems like you've got that figured out. So yeah, you're on the right path. And sorry, earlier my AirPods died. So if y'all said something to me and I just never responded, that's why. I was fiddling it around trying to figure out how I could hear you guys again. But
oh no, you're good.
Anyways, well, do you want to move into our fun questions?
Yes, ma'am. So we'll start with you, Adrian. What state or country have you had the best cheese?
I mean, it's obviously Wisconsin. I mean, it's
I knew you were gonna say that.
Like, there's this company, or there's this cheesery. Yeah, I refer to them as cheeseries. Dairies make milk, cheeseries make cheese. A cheesery can also be a dairy, but either way. There's this place called DuPont, not the DuPont that you're thinking of, but they have a DuPont Colby, and it is like, it is slap your grandma tasty. There's also a place called Renard's Cheese, and they make an absolutely amazing Munster. Mm. So it's definitely a fight between DuPont's Colby and Renard's Munster.
Yeah, you have a specific cheese that you like there. It's funny because up here in Bellingham, where I live, we have a lot of Wisconsinites. And one of my best friends that I used to work with in Dallas, I mean, she was from Wisconsin. So her mom would send us cheese curds through the mail for her. And she would always bring them to work and we'd just chow them down. But Wisconsin cheese is pretty top notch. But I will say, the country I've had the best cheese in is Greece. They have, I love like feta and Mazithra cheese. Oh, so good. So I will say that's my favorite. But what about you, Emma?
This answer is like kind of like tearing me up inside, because I'm gonna say something a little bit unexpected for me. Spain. Oh. As much as like Spain definitely hasn't been my favorite country that I've traveled to, even though I did like my experience when I was there, they had, out of everywhere that I've ever been, some of the best cheese. They use a lot of sheep's milk, and I like a really salty, like I'm the same. I love a feta. I love goats, like anything goat's milk cheese. I love anything that's super salty, briny. I love a little salt crystal in there, a little like, you know, ooh, I like the crunch a little bit, and I like the cream. So I'm definitely going to say Spain, because they, between that and the jamón, oh my God, dude, it's heaven. It's heaven there for me. Tapas heaven.
It's watering right now. My mouth is.
I know. I'm bleeding.
I might have to run to a couple other countries and try some other cheese, because I think, yeah, no, Wisconsin. I mean, I didn't really get to try any cheeses in Afghanistan, so.
Yeah. I mean, they have goats and sheep there, right?
We did get to eat some goat with some locals. That was interesting.
Is goat similar tasting to sheep, or is it more like gamey?
To be honest, it was mixed with rice and dates, and I hadn't eaten in like.
So that shit was.
So it tasted days. Amazing.
Yeah. So yeah. I was like, this could taste like sweaty foot. It's delicious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I was starving. So food was.
Anything better than the MRE.
Emma, you said you love salty cheese. So we know your favorite cheese is like feta, salty.
Gouda.
Oh, okay. Baby. Oh, is Gouda yours? Okay. I'm going to ask you, Adrian, what's your favorite cheese?
I mean, it's a toss up between that DuPont Colby and that Renard's Munster. I mean, Renard's also has this like ghost pepper stuff that every once in a while, you know, you throw it on some tacos and, you know, it's spicy. It's almost angry. Like it's,
I love a good spicy cheese though. I'll tell you. I think my favorite, oh God, this is so hard because I fucking love cheese. I like the stinky cheese, like blue cheese.
Gorgonzola, baby.
Gorgonzola, like anything that stinks, I really like. Adrian, last question is, what's your favorite cheesy food?
So it's either going to be just like some like basic deep fried cheese curds from there's this brewery underneath a bridge in Milwaukee.
I think I've been there.
Yeah, and they have some of the best cheese curds, like deep fried cheese curds. And beyond that, something that might be a little bit more approachable and easier to get for most people would definitely be the cheesy stuffed spuds from Quick Trip.
Mm. Yummy.
Like they're like deep fried tater tots stuffed with cheese.
Ooh. Yeah. I'm so jealous. Like they just don't do cheese curds here. So I'm like, the fact that you can just go somewhere and get them, I'm just jealous.
So there's a few places in Wisconsin that like don't order their cheese curds. The Milwaukee Brewing Company, they just bread a cube of cheddar and deep fry it and call it a cheese curd. Mm. I was fairly upset because they charged like $16 for like four of them too.
Nice.
And believe it or not, Quick Trip's cheese curds are rough. Too much breading. Bread to cheese ratio is way off.
So more cheese, less bread.
Yes. More cheese, less bread. I mean, it's almost like a hush puppy with a whisper of cheddar inside of it.
That sounds amazing. I'm working my appetite up slowly here.
What's your favorite food? Your favorite cheesy food? I feel like I know what you're going to say.
My favorite cheesy food? There's like so many. I'm like, is it like quesadillas? Is it Cheetos? I don't know. And I used to love hot dogs filled with cheese. I like all the like worst things for me that has cheese in them. But I don't know if Cheetos count. It has fake cheese, and I love a good fake cheese. I love my favorite like fake cheese that is probably has no cheese in it is the Taco Bell cheese. The nacho cheese.
Oh my god.
that's blasphemy.
I know it is, but I can't help it. Like I'm addicted. Like I always get the cheese fries or the nacho cheese fries. Yeah, that are like there's no cheese actually on them. But yeah, I'm bad. I like that fake shit.
All right. Well, I'm going to land this plane. It has been so fun talking to you, Adrian. Thank you so much for coming on and joining us. Before we close out this episode, go ahead and give yourself a plug. Like, where can we find you?
You can type in Cheese Pilot as one word into Google. If that didn't find me on the platform that you're looking for, just replace the S with a Z. And I'm literally everywhere. TikTok's the main deal. But you can find me dumping random garbage into Twitter every once in a while. Instagram,
Snapchat. Yeah,
I got Snapchat, but I don't know if it's Cheese Pilot. Yeah. Maybe Cheese Pilot Snap. I forget.
Some people are into Snapchat. Some people really like the Snapchat stories. I'm like, oof, I stopped using that a while ago. I just message people back and forth.
Yeah, no, but you can find me on Twitch. I try and do, at least once a month, some kind of a private pilot study hall where people can show up and ask questions either on TikTok or Twitch, because I know it's expensive to pay your instructor $50 an hour to read a book to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're doing the Lord's work. You really are. God bless you.
Yeah.
Well, it has been really awesome. And I do mean that sincerely. You are really putting out like information, being a resource to people that might need it. I know when I started my aviation journey, even though I come from an aviation family, I still felt very lost in the sauce. So what you're doing is a worthwhile service. So thank you.
Of course. I mean, as I said, I was going to do something anyway. I might as well help as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we appreciate it. And again, thank you so much for coming on. That's it for this week. We're going to like tag everything in the description below. So if you didn't get his at the first time, which is just Cheese Pilot, if it's not Cheese Pilot with an E, it's or an S with a Z, but we're going to link that all down in this week's episode description below. So if you didn't catch it the first time, you can catch it there. Like I said, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for joining us and listening in this episode. We will catch y'all next week. And until then, keep the blue side up and the brown side down. Bye, y'all.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.